Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
We live in a rankist society. We live in a society that's so saturated with subtle forms of rankism that we almost take it to be human nature and indelible and unchangeable, whereas in fact it's quite changeable. And we're at a stage now in history where if we keep doing that, we're going to not succeed as a species. We've gotten this far indulging ourselves in rankism, which is what I call this business of somebody's humiliating nobody's, pulling rank or rankism. But if we keep on doing it, we're going to jeopardize our future as a species, because at last, finally, the weapons available to quote-unquote nobodies are so dangerous, so large, and cause such destruction that if we go on humiliating nobodies, they're going to make life unlivable for us. And we've gotten a foretaste of that with terrorism in the 21st century.
Okay, so you make a distinction between somebodies and nobodies, but do you think that everyone experiences being on both sides at different points in their life or different areas of their lives?
Yes, exactly. I do. I think we've all had the experience of being taken for a nobody. Young children are often taken for nobodies, and old men are taken for nobodies, and everybody gets taken for a nobody by somebody who regards himself or herself as more important. And we're also, though, all of us at times in our life in the somebody role, because, for example, we may have a younger sister or brother, or we may be on a team where there's somebody who's not as good as we are, and then we're the somebody to them. And when you are the somebody to a nobody, when you outrank somebody, it's very important not to translate that into a sense of superiority. It's very important to treat the person of lower rank, which we're just informally calling a nobody here, just to use the vernacular. It's important to treat that person with equal dignity. And that's the problem. Very often, people who regard themselves as somebodies do not treat people who they regard as nobodies with equal dignity. They humiliate them. They shame them. They tease them. They make fun of them. That's where all the trouble begins.
So since it may partially be human nature to have this sense of rankism, why do you think young children feel the need for it? Is it just for attention, or is it because it's part of human nature?
It's part of our culture. And it's more part of our culture than it is human nature, if by human nature you mean something so fundamental that it can't be changed. I think our software, our organization of our minds, can be changed. I've seen that in overcoming attitudes of racism in America in the last half century. I'm seeing it now in the way America is changing its attitudes about homosexuality. I've seen it in the way we treat the elderly. We treat them a lot better than we did when I was a kid. Or a wonderful example is people with mental disabilities or physical disabilities. When I was a child, it was open season on those people. You were free to insult them. And I remember there was one boy in my high school who had Down syndrome. Well, he wasn't in the high school, needless to say. He hung around outside looking through the fence at us, and he was mercilessly teased and reduced to tears regularly. And now that kind of behavior is really almost unthinkable. It would not happen. We can change our wiring. Little children pick up patterns of bullying and what I would call rankest patterns by watching television, by witnessing their parents who indulge in it thoughtlessly, mindlessly. Just as for generations, children picked up racist attitudes by imitating the adult world. Well, when the adult world gets on to rankism and begins to disallow it, children will pick it up much less. We won't have the bullying problems we have in schools today. Children aren't naturally that way. They learn it. They learn it from adults and they learn it from television because humiliation is a staple of television. If you watch television, it's just a sideshow in systematic humiliation of contestants and losers in these reality shows.
You said that rankism is a deeply ingrained part of our culture, but not necessarily part of human nature. How do you think that it came about to be so deeply ingrained?
I think if you look at our long history as a species going back tens of thousands of years, we evolved out of animals that were predators, and we ourselves are predators. And predation has worked well for us because we're smart enough actually to team up on other animals and beat them at the rough, tough game in the wilderness of predation. We were so good at it, in fact, that we realized we could turn it on each other. And once we had the wherewithal to make armies, that's just what we did as a species. So history of the human race is the history of our wars, of our predations, and the history is told by the winners of those wars. And so predation is a strategy that we have used, and some of us at least have prospered with it. It has its limits, though. Predation only works against the other tribe. If you try it within your own tribe, you end up killing off your own tribe. You end up alienating the people within the tribe. Dictators are famously vulnerable to revolutions, wherein the nobodies that they have been exploiting rise up against them and execute them and chop off their heads. So predation works to some extent against another tribe or nation, but within a organization or a society, you want to try and minimize it so that you can get some solidarity and some cooperation out of the group, so that it can be a more effective predator against other groups. So we have these two strategies in human affairs. I call them a predatory strategy and a dignitarian strategy. The dignitarian, by that I mean treating everybody within your group with dignity, respecting them and not exploiting them. And what's happened is that we're moving to a global world, to a global village, to a single group within which residues of predation are very disruptive and very dangerous, as evidenced in the terrorism that we're dealing with now. So that's why I think we can learn to let go of a successful predatory strategy and gradually replace it with a strategy in which we take it for granted that every human being has equal dignity, and we respect that across racial, gender lines, across lines of sexual orientation and age and disability, nationality and religion, the rich and poor, immigrant and non-immigrant. We can respect dignity equally across all of these old divides and essentially bury the remnants of the predatory strategy. I think that's the agenda for the 21st century. It's laying that strategy to rest.
Do you think that rankism is related to self-esteem or insecurity? Do you think that the somebodies either have too much confidence or not enough, and that's why they act the way they do?
That's a wonderful question, because it's getting at the psychological roots of why people humiliate other people. I think your question implies the answer, which is yes. We do it partly to boister our own sense of worth by putting someone else down, because if they are down and if they go down, then we're up. We're superior. So often it's in response to a wound that we've suffered ourselves, and we're trying to make up for it. And sometimes it's just to make ourselves feel better. But it kind of works in the very short run. The instant after you put someone down, you feel important and feel good. But a minute later, you don't feel so good. If you watch yourself closely, you'll see that there's a sense of self-disgust that comes in when you humiliate someone else. That if you really watch closely, you'll see that you're not getting off scot-free. There's some part of yourself that's judging yourself ill for having done that, and you feel guilty about it. And if you feel so guilty that you actually make yourself go and apologize, then it's embarrassing on top of the guilt. So in the long run, you learn as you get older and more experienced not to indignify other people in the first place, because it causes so much blowback in the form of them hating you, them waiting for a chance to get even. If you're the boss and you do it to an employee, that employee will be less loyal to your company. If you're a doctor and put down a nurse, she won't be as ready to help you when the next crisis comes. I mean, if you're a parent and you put down your child may not ever be able to get even, but your child will be wounded and won't learn as well in school the next day because they'll still be smarting from that wound, that indignification that you perpetrated. And if it's just a friend or a spouse or a lover and you put them down, they won't love you as much. They will be wary of you, and you'll feel it. And so all these behaviors are actually counterproductive, but it takes a long time to begin to realize they are, because we live in a rankist society. We live in a society that is so saturated with subtle forms of rankism that we almost take it to be human nature and indelible and unchangeable, whereas in fact it's quite changeable. My generation is a generation that grew up in a racist America and a sexist America. And my generation and people younger than me have learned first to repress their racism and then finally to let go of it. So now, for example, my children dated interracially. My grandchildren are interracial. It takes maybe 3, 4, sometimes 5 generations to change the deep hard wiring in our brains, but we human beings are capable of changing it, unlike certain lower animal species.
In both your books, you talk about rank and rankism. Rankism being the abuse of power that can result from having higher rank, but you don't think that rank itself is the problem?
Rank is very often the problem, but it's not philosophically, it's not the problem. Logically, it's not the problem. One can hold high rank and not abuse it. Many people do. George Washington did in our country. He held high rank. He refused even higher rank, the crown. He retired after 2 terms. And was beloved then and ever since, because he was a person who held high rank and did not abuse his power. He led by example. We have corporate executives and university presidents and doctors and ministers today who do the same thing. They hold high rank, but they don't abuse it. They don't exploit it for advantages that don't inhere in it. They just exercise their rank on behalf of people they're serving, and they view their job as, they view themselves as servants, basically. Mandela was a great example of that among national leaders, and Gandhi and Martin Luther King and others who hold high rank and are held in very high esteem, but don't abuse their rank. So rank is not inherently bad. Having said that, I want to add quickly that rank is so very often abused and exploited that it's almost synonymous with what I call rankism, the abusive rank. It shouldn't be, and it needn't be, and I think we're getting better at handling high rank without slipping on over into abusing it and exploiting those whom we outrank. But I think the distinction is worth making because actually, if you look at it, you don't dislike people who hold high rank until and unless they insult your dignity. If they treat you with respect and honor your dignity as an equal human soul, you're fine with them holding the rank they hold, just so long as they've earned it and handle it in a dignitarian way. More than that, even, we even love people who of high rank who handle it well and serve the group.
So you think rank is an important part of the proper function of our society?
I think it is for now and maybe for the foreseeable future. I mean, after all, people do have different levels of talent and experience, and rank recognizes those talents, that experience. I'm not saying everybody is equal. I'm actually saying the opposite. We're very unequal in any given trait you can think of, whether it be musical or mathematical or speed on a track or weightlifting or anything, beauty, we are radically different. Some people are way better at these things than others. But that's no basis for subjecting them to indignity. When you get on a plane, for example, you want to have the captain in the cockpit flying the plane, not the flight attendant. Or when you go to a chemistry class, it should be the chemistry professor with a PhD in chemistry teaching it, not the freshman. Rank helps us make those distinctions, and so long as it's awarded on the basis of real merit, so long as it's earned, it's okay. But we often get into the situation where someone earns it initially, but then hangs on to it for 50 years, even though he has long since ceased to merit the rank he's holding. This happens in every profession, including the academic profession. So we need for people periodically to demonstrate that they still deserve the rank they hold. And when people have manifestly earned it and are serving the group, most people won't have the slightest bit of problem with calling them president or dean or professor or doctor or anything else. In fact, I think once we begin teaching properly, everybody will find something they're very good at. Everybody will outrank most other people in something. But rank won't carry with it the right to abuse people of lower rank as it does now.
I guess you touched on it already a little bit, but I was going to ask about what areas do you think specifically where you find rankism to be the most pervasive?
It is so pervasive right now, it's hard to single out an area. I've looked at all the different professions. You look at the medical profession, for example, and you see rankism from top to bottom. You see it in the doctors towards nurses. There are four different levels, ranks of nurses, and you see it in each level towards the lower level. And finally, the lowest level nurse will indulge in insulting the so-called candy striper, which is the volunteer who comes in and wears those striped outfits and just does it out of the goodness of her heart. Then you see rankism between doctors and patients. Although we're overcoming a lot of that now because we've realized that these doctors are MDs, but they're not MD-ities. They're just doctors, and they're our partners in healing, and we are their clients and can take their counsel as advice, not as orders. So there's a big leveling going on, and sometimes I force my own doc to recognize it by calling him by his first name, which is what he calls me by. But once we've got over that hurdle, I'm happy to call him Dr. Floyd because he does know a lot more than I do about these diseases and has seen thousands of patients. So that's worth something, just so long as he doesn't keep me waiting 2 hours to see him, which is a kind of rankism that is often practiced in medicine. They don't schedule their lives well with any respect for their patients. So everywhere you look, I've just picked out medicine, but if you look at corporate life, if you look at the prison system. You see an egregious form of rankism going on in prisons, where prisoners, instead of being treated with dignity, are treated, subjected to chronic indignity. What does that do? Builds up a head of steam in them. The minute they're released from prison, they're very apt to commit another crime because they have so much rage churning inside them due to the abuse they were subjected to by prison guards and other prisoners. Everywhere you look, in government, in bureaucracy, in the church, where you just had a terrible sexual abuse scandal, that was rankism. In homes, long-term life care facilities, the elderly are often subjected to abuse. Everywhere you look, it's still prevalent. Just as when I was a boy, everywhere you looked, there was racism. And everywhere, everyone you asked said, oh, that's human nature. We can't do anything about it. That's just the way it is. Those people really are inferior. Well, that turned out to be nonsense. That turned out to be a clever rationale through which we could exploit 15% of the people in this country. And this is not over yet, but we have at least put racists on the defensive. That's the first step. When we can put rankists on the defensive, we'll be halfway there to eradicating it.
Can you remember the precise moment when you got this idea about rankism and dignity?
I think it was, I know the year was 1995, and I'd been playing with these ideas that we've been discussing here for decades. And I think it was when I realized that I myself was stuck in nobody land, that I wasn't being taken for a nobody. Sure, I'd been a college president. I'd been a physics teacher. I had been a somebody at times, and that was why being taken for a nobody was all the more painful, because I knew what it, hadn't always been taken for a nobody, but I was found myself one in the mid-90s, and I remember waking up in the middle of the night with the phrase on my lips, and it was, nobodies of the world unite. We have nothing to lose but our shame. And I thought, wow, that sounds a little bit like Karl Marx. And it was. It was a takeoff on his famous revolutionary slogan. But it wasn't about class. It was about rank. It was about the somebody-nobody distinction, not the rich-poor distinction, not the owner-worker distinction. And I thought, now that's a new way to build a movement for liberty and justice for all, is to focus it on rank and let that be the keystone of this philosophy, of this political analysis, so that it permeates into all our social organizations, not just our political ones. And then as we make progress in all our social organizations, universities and healthcare and churches and families and schools and everything else, then that new value system will end up affecting our political system as well. And in that way, we can achieve the goals, some of the goals that Marx actually wrote about. I don't regard myself as a Marxist. I've never really even studied him. But I do share the idea that it's unfair that a small group of people should have complete domination and enormous wealth, and that in America, 20% of us shouldn't even have a living wage. I think we need to fix that, and I think we can do it through an analysis of rankism and dignity. And it really was seeded that night through that slogan coming through my mind.
How did you get from being a physicist and a college president to the position that you're in today as a theorist and a writer of practical handbooks for social change?
It was an accident. I followed my father into physics, but my mother was a social crusader, and I think her imprint on me ultimately was the larger. So while I was being a scientist and doing physics, I was also secretly teaching in a local ghetto high school because I had a feeling that that was important to do back in the 60s, and the people interested me, and I felt sure that if they were taught properly, they could learn as well as anybody else, and wanted to prove this. And that led me into education. And when my alma mater was looking for a president, they wanted somebody who'd had some experience in race relations, because that was the hottest issue of the day in the late 60s. And so I really, at that point, was hijacked out of my physics career into a job which turned out to be a job about more about social justice than it was about academic leadership. The great issues of the late 60s and early 70s were really issues of social, societal justice towards young people, towards African Americans and other minorities in the United States, and towards women and people with disabilities, and towards gays. And all these revolutions occurred at once, and I sensed even then that they had a common denominator, and finally found that common denominator. It's abuse of the power inherent in rank, and I called it rankism. And I think Barack Obama is someone who's addressing abuses of power more than he specifically wants to carry on in the old tradition of identity politics. He's moved beyond identity politics to post-racial, post-identity politics, in which he sees the suffering of a white person being paid a minimum wage is just as serious as that of a black person in the same circumstances. It's really not race that's our main problem today. It's the fact that we are exploiting 40 million people in this country who are the poor, and we're living, trying to live and get by on less than a living wage. That's our biggest problem. That's a problem as serious as the racial problem was in the 60s. And again, it threatens America's identity. If we don't deal with the indignity that is visited upon 40 million people in this country daily because they live below the poverty line, because they don't have health care, because they don't have access to higher education, if we don't deal with that, we will have failed the American dream. We will not delivered on Jefferson's promise of equal liberty and justice for all. So I think Barack Obama is the one politician out there now who senses that we again have to make good on America's promise. We again have to live up to the dream, just as we did 50 years ago. We did it then, we can do it again. And that's what he's trying to tell the country. And it's not going to be easy. It's going to actually be harder than it was to create a multicultural society, which was very hard, and we haven't finished yet, but we've made a good start. Now we need to make a start on creating a dignitarian society in which we actually have dignity for everybody, not just for certain identity groups. And it's because Barack Obama has intuitively sensed that, partly due to his own background, that he's leading us in that direction. And I think he'll take us as far as we let him take us. He'll be as post-racial as we allow him to be. We may be more stuck in old racist views than he is. So it's going to come back to us, the American people, on whether we let him take us where he wants to.
Would you say that Obama has an emotional appeal to his audience?
Yes, I think he does, because I think that's why he's connecting with so many people. It's at a heart level where he's not talking about black suffering. He's talking about human suffering. He's not talking about dignity for blacks. He's talking about dignity for people. And he instinctively treats old and young, black and white, gay and straight, immigrants and natives, with respect and with equal dignity. He doesn't attack his opponent in a way that is undignified. Sure, you can disagree on policy, and he does. But he's been quite good, if not 100% consistent, at refraining from personal ad hominem attacks. He also extends equal dignity to foreign leaders in his willingness to talk with them and not play the card that America is special and above all that. He really has abandoned the idea that America is exceptional and shouldn't be held to the same rules as other nations. So I think this is, he's a herald of the politics of dignity, and that politics is a safer politics internationally for us than a policy of belligerence or a policy of exceptionalism in which we take ourselves to be superior.
How does his emotional appeal to an audience differ from President Bush's kind of emotional appeal?
Bush's appeal is to like-minded people who share his ideology or share his enthusiasm for punishing people who behave in ways we don't like. And you can evoke passion from a group by proposing to punish its enemies. That's been done by leaders for millennia. It's a little bit trickier to evoke passion from a group when it's about treating people fairly and treating people equally and respecting everyone's dignity. But in fact, it's a better strategy if your interest is in making us safe and secure. The strongest defense involves not giving offense. In other words, it's not enough just to have the biggest army in the world if you want to be safe in today's world, where even relatively minor players can wreak havoc through terrorism. And I don't even mean nuclear terrorism. I mean it causes enough disruption just to bomb five subways, as in London a year or two ago. That can disrupt a country and cost it enormous time and energy and money protecting itself against that. It's a better strategy is not to treat anyone in a way that makes them even want to do that. Or if, after you have come to treat societies and religions and cultures with dignity, there's still a few angry young men in the group, then their own people will rein them in. So it will be relatively easy. Terrorists can only function successfully when they have a lot of social support. If their co-religionists are deeply against what they're doing because they feel respected by the United States or Great Britain, their co-religionists will handle it. That's actually a subtler policy. I think it comes closer to being what Barack Obama's policy would be. It doesn't mean you don't have a muscular and robust defense department. You do, just in case and as a warning. But you also have a very muscular, robust State Department that deals in diplomacy and does so with equal respect for every culture on earth. He goes to the level of human dignity, not dignity for blacks or dignity for females or gays, but human dignity. There's something about him that has led him to do that and to be, I think, a harbinger of the politics of dignity, which is the next step beyond the democracy we've got. He's trying to take us there instinctively. I think it would help him take us there more effectively if he had an analysis of rankism and how rankism causes indignity. Because you can't actually combat indignity unless you know what causes it, and unless you have a name for it, and unless you can pin that name on people who indulge in it. It's just like the women's movement. It was just a consciousness-raising phenomenon until women came up with the word sexism. But once they had a label that they could pin on men who were indulging in abuse and discrimination towards them, then they were much more effective at changing male behavior. That happened about in the late 60s. And very rapidly, they won some important legislative successes because they could depict the opposition as sexist. And nobody was comfortable being depicted that way, just as no one's comfortable being depicted and or being called a racist. And I hope it won't be long before people are equally uncomfortable being called a rankist. I hope rankism will become as uncool as racism and sexism are.
So do you think then that what you're proposing with dignitarianism is closer to approximating what human nature really is then?
Yes, you know, I do. I think it's what human nature has wanted to be. I think it's what the biblical prophets foresaw 2,000 years ago. I think statements like treat others as you would have them treat you are forecasts or predictions of the equilibrium state that we are inching our way towards over the centuries. The interesting thing, though, is that in this century, we're going to actually make enormous progress on that old agenda. If we don't, we're going to do our species in. I think there are all sorts of signs that we are going to make progress towards actually operationalizing the golden rule in the 21st century. Now, that sounds that sounds like a coincidence. Why should it be now? Well, it's now because human beings are finally getting affluent enough to be able to let go of the predatory strategy, which is doing more harm than good. And endangering all of us now that we have such gigantic weapons that we can use on each other. It's happening because we have had practice in the last 50 years against subspecies of rankism, namely racism, sexism, homophobia, ableism, and ageism. Anti-Semitism. We've warmed up, so to speak, by showing that we can tackle those old isms and disallow them, and gradually, over 4 to 6 generations, eliminate them. You don't do this overnight. Rankism won't be eliminated overnight. It will take 4 generations. It will take the 21st century. But we can and must do it if we want our species to prosper. And if we want, in the meantime, to be at our maximum effectiveness in terms of learning and creating and producing. Companies, I spoke at Microsoft last year, and Microsoft, inside its walls, is remarkably dignitarian. They have to be. Why? Because they've got a whole lot of 21-year-olds running around that place who are great programmers. And if they didn't treat them with dignity, they'd move to Google in a minute. They'd go somewhere else. So the restaurant at Microsoft has 22 ethnic restaurants. All the food is free. Everybody, whether you're in a sloppy T-shirt or a dress or a tuxedo, is treated with dignity. Doesn't mean you can't disagree and disagree quite ferociously about an issue that's technical. But I found it to be remarkably dignitarian because it's the only way they can be effective as a company. On the other hand, employees at Microsoft were acutely aware of the fact that they are not regarded, that they are regarded as a bully by other companies, that they are not seen as respecting the dignity of other companies. So they were very upset by this split in their image, internal and external. Okay, Joe, ask that question.
How would you respond to someone calling the dignitarian approach a liberal bleeding heart approach to being human?
By saying that if all it was going after rankism, that charge could be leveled at it. But I'm upholding rank. That's a conservative thing to do, to uphold rank and the power of rank and to see rank as a very important tool of human organization. The way conservatives and liberals differ, if you look at it closely, is their attitude towards authority. Conservatives tend to automatically respect authority and overlook and downplay instances where authorities abuse their rank. So with conservatives are pro-rank and not so concerned about rankism. Liberals are just the opposite. Liberals are very concerned about infringement on their liberties, about people abusing power, and they tend to denigrate rank itself. They tend to question all authority and to think it's inherently evil. Both attitudes are incomplete. You need rank to have effective, timely organization. You need to disallow rankism to make those organizations really hum and really work, and they won't do that if half the employees are angry at them because they're indignant over the indignities that are befalling them. So this is a synthesis of liberal and conservative politics, and that's why I don't call it either libertarian or egalitarian. That's why I invented the new word dignitarian to describe this politics.
Okay, so you talk a little bit about economic justice. What exactly is economic justice, and how does dignitarianism play into that, especially in our modern business world?
Well, dignitarianism means equal dignity for all, and a person cannot be said to enjoy equal dignity if they can't feed their family, if they can't send their kids to college. That is not equal dignity. Equal dignity doesn't mean economic equality, but it means certain basic things, like you should be able to make enough money to support your family. A couple ought to be able to support a family of four. A man ought to be able to support himself, and so on. And that means not just a minimum wage, but some kind of a living wage. And it certainly means universal health care and equal access to quality higher education. Those are the basic three pillars of it. There are other aspects as well, but the concept of economic justice doesn't mean that everybody gets exactly the same pay. It would be silly to pay you or me the same money paid to Brad Pitt if we were to make a movie, because no one would go to our movies, but they'll go to his movies. He deserves more money for it, let's say. I'm just picking that out of a hat, but you see what I mean. There are people who are very good at certain things, and they have a right to get market price for them, it seems to me. But that does not justify exploiting 20% to 30% of the population of the country, on whose backs we are all riding. I mean, these poor people who run our restaurants and harvest our food and mine our coal and do all the menial jobs, these people are actually our benefactors. They're the philanthropists, because we're paying half what we should be for their goods and services. So they get exploited, and it's a modern form, a subtle form of slavery. By keeping them in poverty, we are basically keeping them in slavery. It's different only in the form, but not in the result that old-fashioned slavery, where you wore chains around your ankles, produced. These are subtler chains, but they're chains nonetheless. And we can, I think, persuade people that they have a right to a dignified life, and that people will then stand up for their own dignity long before they'd ever march for justice. But once they have stood up for dignity and begin discussing what dignity means in millions of conversations over a 10-year period, they will then decide that equal dignity requires that they have health care like everyone else, and that they can send their kids to a good college, and that they earned enough to pay for a house. And that is a first approximation to a dignitarian society. Now, a second approximation will come up with some other things that people want and feel they need to live in equal dignity, and we'll get to that point when we get there. Meanwhile, we start with the big three, which is healthcare, education, and a living wage.
What is the incentive for business organizations to decrease their rankism within the organization?
It's the same incentive that a tribe had 10,000 years ago for operating in a way that respected the dignity of all the tribal members. Namely, that tribe becomes a more potent force. It can defend itself better against other tribes because it has solidarity. Within a company, employees who love their directors, the president, their executives, those employees love them because they sense that they are valued and respected. Those employees will go the extra mile. Those employees, not only that, they won't get sick as often. Illness on the job is caused by chronic indignity more than anything else, by the stress that builds up under daily humiliations, small ones and large ones. I read somewhere that being subjected to chronic humiliation for 10 years is the equivalent of smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day for 10 years. It takes that much away from your health and your life. So there'll be fewer lower health care costs. Insurance can go down. People won't steal pencils and won't steal larger things. You will be happier. In a word, you will be happier on the job, and happy workers are better workers. I think CEOs are beginning to recognize this now, but it's not enough for the CEO to go around and shake hands with everybody and have one Christmas party for everybody. The CEO actually has to give personal recognition to each employee, and that means telling the woman who vacuumed the rug at midnight that you appreciate what she did. That means knowing what everybody contributes and either eliminating the job because that contribution isn't needed in the company, or admitting that that contribution is needed and acknowledging the person for making it and paying them a living wage for doing so. When those things happen, companies are the best part of our lives. They're as good, they're on a level with family life. They are a kind of family life. They're wonderful places to work. And I think that America can produce a dignitarian workplace within about 20 years. We've produced already a non-racist workplace, not quite a non-sexist workplace, but we're getting there. If you want to get fired from your job now, all you have to do is use the N-word, and you won't be in that job 5 minutes later. We've made some good changes, but we have not eliminated indignity across the board. We've only eliminated it when it's a white doing it to a black. Why should a white be able to subject another white to indignity any more than subject a black to it? Why should a black be able to visit indignity upon another black? Can't call it racism, they're both black. It's rankism, and it's no less justified, and it's just as counterproductive. So businesses very much have it in their interest in terms of the bottom line to eliminate rankism and create dignitarian companies. And it does not mean democratic companies. Companies are never going to run on one person, one vote, nor should they, nor should schools. That would be the sloppy, bleeding heart liberal approach to these problems. That doesn't work. Rank has its place. Expertise is precious. But dignity has its place too, and it's a prime place, and indignity has no place.
Could you give an example of a company that's moved in this direction?
Well, I'm told that certain companies are relatively dignitarian. There is an organization now called True Blue that actually recognizes companies for these practices. And a few that I know of that are touted as dignitarian are Ben & Jerry's ice cream, or even the cows are treated with dignity. Whole Foods, where employees seem to be very happy. I see them daily, and I've talked to them about it, and I've read about the practice. And these are also CEOs who do not pay themselves 500 times what they pay the janitor. They pay themselves maybe 10 times what they pay the janitor, but not 500 times. When you get up in those kind of multiples, when the executives are making hundreds of times more money than the lowest paid people, it's a very likely that that company is rankist, that those executives are feathering their own nest, are getting boards of directors with whom they golf to vote them higher salaries, and then they return the favor on their friends' boards of directors. So other companies that do it, I have heard of a carpet company in Georgia and Gore-Tex. And there are others. Barrett Kohler Publishers is one such. I know there are ones I'm not mentioning because I haven't made it a practice to study them. But they are known to employees as wonderful places to work. and where people don't leave and want to stay and earn their continued keep by performing at their top of their abilities. So I think they're actually companies that will make more money, and I think that's why companies will become dignitarian, not to be nicey-nicey, not to be goody-goody two-shoes, but actually to compete more effectively in the marketplace.
You've spoken to groups all over the world about this idea. What has been their response?
Well, I think some people regard it as take me for a dreamer, you know, and don't see how immensely practical it is. And I think at the national level, it is a bit of a vision and a bit of a dream. But at the level of your company, your school, your church, your doctor, it's not. It's totally realizable there that we can demand the eradication of rankism within those organizations. So that's where I think we're going to start. We're not going to start with a million-man march, but we are going to start by reforming a million organizations so we prune the rankism out of them and do so because the organization, the resulting organizations will be more creative, more productive. If they're companies, they'll actually make more money. That's where it's got to start. Then it will move into the political realm. And the dream that some people think this is will be seen to be quite practical. Already, I think, at the level of international policy, avoiding rankist treatment of other countries is very much in our self-interest and will quite quickly become adopted, even though the last administration has not honored it so well.
Do you see a career for young people as consultants to business organizations and other organizations in making the transformation into a company or organization that promotes human dignity in order to make more money?
You know, I do. I think there's a whole profession here of experts who will go around to different organizations, be invited in, and give a two-day workshop on how to transform your organization into a completely dignitarian one. And we did this at Oberlin, where I was president, with regard to the issue of sexism. Oberlin was a co-ed school before any other school in the world, actually, and it prided itself on equal education for females. But in fact, women were very upset with it. There are lots of ways the education was slanted towards males and was uncongenial to women. So we had a commission that lasted for a year and a half and went around and interviewed women all over the place of what they would like to see changed. We drew up a list of 23 things and sent them to the person who had the power or the group that had the power to effect that change. And a lot of these changes could be made in a day or a week or a year, and some of them took a decade, but they've all been worked on. Now, the same thing can be done with regard to dignity of people, not just dignity of women. And that's what you need to do. Hold a commission in your company, in your church or school, on the status of persons. And invite people to tell when they feel their dignity is secure and when it's under assault. And then draw up a list of things that we need to do, changes to be made that will ensure dignity for everybody, from the janitor to the president and everybody in between. Every organization can do that. Experts, especially young people, are really good at this because young people are instinctively more dignitarian than old people who have achieved high status and may well have been abusing it for a decade or two and regard those abuses now as their prerogatives. To get them to see that those are not prerogatives is not easy, and they will fight this. I find in the talks I've given, which I've been doing now for 5 years all over the world, in India just recently, and my book came out in China this month, young people instantly get this thesis. It hardly needs any explaining. The word is new to them, the word rankism, but they instantly understand it and put it to good use. Women and blacks get it very quickly, too. The group that's slowest to get this distinction, actually, are white Anglo males. And that's because they have predominantly, more than other groups, enjoyed high rank. And they're fearful that this analysis will restrict the prerogatives of that rank. And yes, it may to some extent insofar as those prerogatives haven't been earned. But it's not meant to erode the power inherent in rank. It's just meant to eliminate the abuses of the power that go with rank.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.